Episode 8 of By Our Own Hands. We have reached Loch na Cully. We have stood here for several minutes as I've told my tale, my father's tale. Dr. Foxlow listened patiently. His expression is now pained and thoughtful. "Do you believe the tale?" Dr. Foxlow asked. "I am not sure if it is all true, but my father insisted that my family settled in Wicklow after the defeat of Edward Bruce. He told me that they lived there for a century before the English of Dublin raided their lands. They survived the raid by fleeing deep into the Wicklow Mountains, but when they returned to their homes, they found they had no homes to return to. All that was left were the smoldering remains of their former homes and the bodies of the dead. They left for Leash in search of a home, simply because their ancestors had once claimed it as their home," I say. "I believe your tale is true, or at the very least, full of many truths. Terrible truths. My country fought a brutal war with Scotland. The Scots triumphed because they learned to meet English brutality with an equal amount of brutality. They were battle-hardened and black-hearted by the time they arrived on the shores near Carrickfergus," he says. "We both look out over Loch na Cully. It is cooler and the wind has gathered strength. I wrap my shawl more closely about me. Dr. Foxlow looks in my direction and nods. "We should be returning. Mrs. O'Donnell has probably prepared a fine spread," he says with a smile. I return his smile and we begin our journey back to the house. We are silent as we walk side by side. The silence between us is no longer unsettling. Instead, it is the silence that can linger gracefully between two friends. I remind myself that he is Mrs. Adair's friend and not mine. He is a pleasant stranger that I cannot trust. I still must share some details of my life with him to further conceal others. We reached the house and Mrs. O'Donnell opens the door. She must have been watching for our approach. Have we really been gone for so long? I look at her face and see worry ebbing away as she watches me approach. She takes the doctor's coat and my shawl. "Did you two enjoy your walk?" she asks. "Yes, thank you, Mrs. O'Donnell. It was fine," Dr. Foxlow says. "Yes, it was very nice," I say. "Good, very good. You will both have worked up an appetite," she says, smiling before disappearing with the coat and shawl. We walk to the dining room and seat ourselves. Mrs. O'Donnell enters shortly afterwards. The shadow of concern has completely left her face. She smiles warmly at the two of us. "I have prepared chicken and a few courses of vegetables. I have some fresh bread from this morning. I'll bring you both some tea before I bring your meals," she says. "I hope you will be joining us, Mrs. O'Donnell," Dr. Foxlow asks. Her smile fades. She is suddenly completely flustered. I can't help but smile. "Certainly not," she says. "You certainly will. I am a doctor, not a prince. Join us, please. I insist," he says. I nod encouragement at Mrs. O'Donnell. "If you insist," she says. "Let me help you with the tea," I say, standing up. "We won't be having any of that," she says. I sit down obediently. I can feel my cheeks redden. Dr. Foxlow looks at me with mock seriousness. We both begin to laugh. I know that he can disregard the rules of etiquette to some degree because he is one of the quality people, while someone of my social standing could be beaten with a stick for showing the same lack of regard for these rules. His generosity is appreciated, but it is also a painful reminder. Mrs. O'Donnell returns with a tea tray, which she deposits onto the table before leaving the room again. I know that this is her subtle way of allowing me to make the tea without asking me to do so. I quickly make 3 cups of tea. I pushed the tea tray aside just in time as Mrs. O'Donnell re-enters the room, carrying another tray full of cold chicken and large bowls of cooked vegetables. She quickly places the food onto the table. She moves with the graceful deftness that only comes with years of experience. We do not speak as we eat. I can see that Mrs. O'Donnell is uncomfortable as she begins to eat, but she soon relaxes. Her meal is excellent. The coolness of the food is ideal after a long walk that left small beads of sweat along my brow. The doctor occasionally stops eating to compliment Mrs. O'Donnell, who graciously thanks him before returning to her meal. She occasionally eyes him as if she were trying to determine if he is a fool or simply highly unusual. He is not a prince, but he might just be as decent as he appears to be. I will not let my guard down, but I will leave myself open to this possibility. When we finish eating, Mrs. O'Donnell clears the table. She brings us more tea. I am grateful that she does not bring sweets, too, because I would burst if I ate another bite. She does not join us for tea. When she leaves the room, the doctor leans forward conspiratorially. "I like her very much," he says. I smile and look away. He is a coy one. Finally, I return my gaze to him. "I do too, Dr. Foxlow. She is very dear to me," I say. "You two could be mother and daughter," he says. I nod appreciatively. It is an oddly personal thing for him to say to me, but I have shared some very personal details with him. I am not taken aback. "Yes, I consider her to be another mother. I have felt this way for many years," I say. He nods. I can see that he is trying to work up to asking me a question again. I had become quite good at reading the doctor's face. "What did you want to ask, doctor?" I ask with a coy smile. "Am I really so obvious?" he asks. We both laugh. "Very well, there is something I wanted to ask. It is pertaining to your story," he says. I nod to encourage him. "In your story, the descendants of the Normans call themselves English. I have read that they often considered themselves Irish. It was often said that they were more Irish than the Irish themselves." I nod because this is very true. After the devastation caused by the Scots, Ireland had very little time to heal before she and the whole world were brought to their knees by the Black Death, I say. "Yes, the bubonic plague at the time of King Edward III," he interjects. "The English of Ireland were weakened by the wars with the Scots, but so were the native Irish. When the Black Death came, the English were far more devastated than the native Irish," I say. "Why is that?" he asks. "If you lived like the English, you died like the English," I say. He gives me a perplexed look. I quickly explain before I can cause offense. "Dr. Foxlow, you can appreciate the importance of cleanliness, I am sure. People often assume that medieval people could not. That is not entirely true. They did understand that there was a correlation between filthiness and illness. They assumed that filthiness could only affect your well-being if you inhaled, literally digested, the filthiness. Bad air was blamed for the plague. The name they gave to this plague-causing stench was miasma," I say. "Yes, I have heard of that," he says. "People would press scented handkerchiefs to their faces in an effort to battle the plague. They would carry flowers in their pockets, too," I say. Dr. Foxlow clears his throat. "Ring-a-ring-a-roses, a pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, we all fall down," he says. I am bewildered by his strange behavior and his sudden urge to recite a children's song. "The plague caused a rash, a ring of roses. People carried flowers in their pockets, a pocket full of posies, to ward off the plague. The victims of the plague were burned and reduced to ash. People believed that, in time, all of humanity would succumb or that we would all fall down, he says. I am impressed with his knowledge of these details. This must be obvious because I can see that he is quite proud of himself. I shake my head. It is true. The song you sung as a small child has been sung by children for more than 500 years, he says. Doctor, I don't believe that bad air was the killer of so many, I say. He nods his head in agreement. The plague was so terrible in England because so many people could not escape it. The plague was trapped within walled, fortified cities and towns. In my country, the Normans arrived and built themselves fine castles. Towns grew up around the castles. They were built to be just like those in England. People were walled in with all of their filth about them. The plague came, and anyone living within one of those walled towns was trapped and far more likely to contract this vicious killer. The native Irish lived in open to us, the petty kingdoms of clans. There were no walls. They lived in open, spacious conditions, I say. He nods thoughtfully. Some say that Dublin lost more than a third of its population. Limerick is said to have suffered even greater losses. 90% of Kilkenny's population perished during those dark days. The same could not be said of any Irish Tua, I add. If you lived like the English, you died like the English, he says, repeating my words. The English of Ireland weakened further, and the native Irish rose up. They began to take back some of the lands taken from their ancestors. Sometimes they were successful, other times they were not. The English of Ireland responded to the might of the native Irish by becoming as they were. In time, there was very little to distinguish the English of Ireland from the natives, I say. He nods again. I catch my breath and continue. And the English were not the only ones becoming Irish in the century that brought the Bruces and the Black Death. Dr. Foxlow looks at me questionably. Who else became Irish, he asks. The Galloglass, of course, I say. I can see that the good doctor does not comprehend the term Galloglass. Doctor, my country has produced many wise kings. It has produced some foolish ones, but they have all been proud. Many have been too proud. Pride can compromise one's wisdom, and it can cause one to act rashly. This has happened many times throughout Irish history. The result has been many fierce, short-lived wars, I add. My country has also produced many monarchs that are full of themselves, he says, with another one of his coy smiles. I chuckle. Yes, but my country's constant royal feuding resulted in a need for additional warriors. As the native Gaelic Irish rose, their strength and wealth increased. They began to strengthen their alliances with the clans of Scotland. These alliances had been important for centuries. Marriages between Irish and Scottish families were common. The heirs of powerful Irish families were fostered in Scotland, and the Scots, in return, sent their privileged sons to be fostered in Ireland. Some believe that Edward the Bruce was fostered by Brian's family, I say. I take a sip of my tea before continuing. The Irish chiefs began to look to Scotland for warriors to fight their wars. Galloglass were mercenary Scottish soldiers that were paid to come to Ireland and fight for an Irish king. Some of the clans became well known for their brave warriors. These clans soon began to permanently settle in Ireland, especially in Ulster. These Galloglass families became an elite hereditary class of warriors within Ulster society, I add. If the best king is descended from kings, then the best warrior is descended from warriors, he asks. Yes, many of the people in these parts are descended from Galloglass warriors, I say. Did Ireland's experience with the Bruces have an impact on these Scots-Irish Galloglass families, he asks. No, I don't believe so. Ulster culture is very similar to Scotland's Gaelic culture. Even our languages are nearly identical. I'm sure some of my people felt differently since the arrival of the Protestant Scots-Irish, who have taken over so much of Ulster, but the Bruces did not change the strong bonds between my people and the clans of Scotland, I say. Your people are justified in their resentment of the Scots-Irish Protestants, he says in a low voice. I agree, but I also think they are truly Irish. The Galloglass and the English became Irish. The Scots-Irish Protestants did too. I see no difference between them, I say. He smiles and nods his head. He doesn't speak. I wonder if he believes that I am being truthful. I am. If you consider the soil of this land Irish, and yourself just as Irish, then you are Irish. If you walk across this land as a conqueror, then you are not Irish. The land does not belong to you, and you do not belong to it. Mr. Adair sometimes called himself British. Other times he called himself an Irishman. But he told most he hailed from Scots and was a proud Scotsman. That is what he preferred to tell those that would listen to him, and many would. So it did not come as a surprise to anyone when he brought Scots to Derryvay, I say. The doctor stares at me, but he doesn't speak. I know he is willing me to continue, so I will speak of that day that forever changed Derryvay. Not long after Sean and I moved into our rooms, we noticed a change had occurred in the house. The members of the household staff that I had met began to whisper about Mother. Sean told me to pay no heed, but it still bothered me. My first clue that Mother's station had changed came one morning while I ate breakfast with Mrs. O'Donnell and the other members of the household staff. Mother wasn't present, and I was concerned. I had been seated at the table next to Sean. I had my doll lying in my lap. I took her everywhere. Sean would occasionally tease me, but I didn't care. I looked about and noticed that everyone was beginning to eat. I knew that when old man Seamus was late the day before, Mrs. O'Donnell had checked on him to make certain he hadn't overslept. Only when she returned with him had the rest of us begun to eat. No one was checking on Mother. They had all begun to eat their morning meal. "Where is Mother?" I asked. Sean nudged me and made a hushing noise. Kate McDermott giggled. Her sister glanced at her. Everyone else stopped eating and stared at their plates. Mrs. O'Donnell sighed. "Aoife, your mother is taking her morning meal elsewhere," she said. She gave me a look that told me I shouldn't ask more questions. I looked about the table and saw that everyone had resumed their eating. I looked at Sean with some confusion. He did not return my gaze. After eating my breakfast, I waited for everyone to leave. I knew that Mrs. O'Donnell would clear the table. I followed her about until she turned around and acknowledged me. She sighed again. "Poor child, how can I explain this?" she asked, more to herself than to me. I waited patiently. She looked at me sympathetically. She bent down to my level and put her hands on my shoulders. "Your mother will be taking her meals in the study room for the time being," she said. "Why?" I asked. "Because Mr. Adair wants her to," she said. "Why does he want her to eat alone?" I asked. "She is not eating alone. She is taking her morning meals with Mr. Adair," she said in a quiet voice. I thought of Kate McDermott's giggles. I knew something shameful was happening, but I couldn't understand what it was or what it could mean. I nodded my head. "You will not speak of this with your mother or Mr. Adair. Do you understand?" she asked. Mrs. O'Donnell's expression was severe, but then it softened. I nodded again. She stood up and pressed her hands over the sides of my hair. "Love, I know this must be confusing. In time, you will understand. Right now, you cannot ask questions. You simply cannot," she said. I gave her a faint smile. She leaned down and kissed the top of my head. "Now off with you. I will find you later," she said. I left the kitchen and wandered to the stables. Sean was already working. He was brushing out Pegasus's mane. I was grateful that he was alone. As soon as he saw me, he stopped and put down his brush. I sat down on a bench. He sat down next to me. "Why did Kate McDermott laugh at me?" I asked. "She is a stupid cow," Sean said. I laughed at this. He smiled, and then his smile faded. "Aoife, I am going to tell you something, but you cannot speak of it with anyone but me. This is very important. Can I trust you?" he asked. "Yes, of course. You know you can," I said. "I know," he said quietly. "Go on," I said impatiently. "Yesterday, Mr. Adair called the entire household staff into the dining room. He told everyone that your mother was to be welcomed into our house. He said that her duties would be to see to certain household necessities. In other words, her duties will only consist of light duties," he said. "What do you mean by light duties?" I asked. "Oh, such as opening a door to guests, taking care of the coat closets, tending the many fires, those kinds of duties," he said. "She won't have to do the more difficult task?" I asked. "Yes, these kinds of duties are usually assigned to someone with seniority and privilege," he said. He paused for a moment and looked at me. I nodded my head to indicate that I understood, even though I didn't. Mother had no seniority. We had only just arrived. I couldn't understand how she could have earned any special privileges either. "He told Mrs. O'Donnell that your mother will be taking her morning meals with him in his study," he added. "Mr. Adair likes Mother very much, doesn't he?" I asked, looking away. Sean hesitated before answering. "Yes, he does." "Mr. Adair didn't take his morning meals with anyone at Belgrove House," I said. "Normally a landlord does not dine with his maid," he said in a soft voice. I blushed. I knew that Mr. Adair considered Mother to be more than just his maid. "He fancies Mother," I said flatly. "Yes, he does," Sean said. "He is one of the quality people, and Mother is not. His fancy will not change this," I said. I stood up and walked out of the stable. I knew that Mother had been bound to Father in ways that only married people were bound to each other. I knew that Mr. Adair fancied Mother in a way that was similar to the fancy my father had felt for her. I also knew that Mr. Adair could favor Mother, but he could not marry her. Even at my young age, I understood this. Mother was his, but he was not hers. The days following these revelations, I heard whispers among the household staff. They looked at Mother with disdain and treated her with cold deference, as if she were a landlord's wife. She, in her maid's uniform, was not and never would be a landlord's wife. She bore it all with impassivity and seeming indifference. I knew that this was a facade and that she must burn with shame. I hoped she did. I burned with shame for her. I burned and I bled. "While now, O degenerate daughter of Aaron, how fallen is thy fame, and through ages of bondage and slaughter, our country shall bleed for thy shame." Did the great poet Thomas More have someone particular in mind as he wrote these words? I can't help but wonder, because his sentiments matched mine. It was clear to all that Mother had become a disgrace, a degenerate daughter of Aaron. Her head was held high. She was proud and defiant. She maintained this facade for almost everyone. She made an exception for Father Daniel Kerr. Her facade faded, and she cast her eyes down when she was in his presence. It was only a week after I learned of Mother's disgrace that I saw Father Kerr approach her. I hid myself behind an open door and listened. "Mrs. Dorian, may I have a word with you?" he asked. Yes, Father, Mother said in a voice that was little more than a whisper. I peeked through the door. I could not see Mother's face, but I could see Father Care's. He had a youthful, pale face, but his dark hair was beginning to gray. His expression and the tone of his voice made it clear that he had neither disdain nor respect for Mother. He looked at her with pity and even something akin to remorse. I could see that he would not defer to her in an effort to honor Mr. Adair, but he didn't add to her misery. "Has your child taken Holy Communion?" he asked. "No, Father, she has not yet received her first Holy Communion," she said. "I will see to it," he said. "Thank you, Father," she said. "Good day, Mrs. Dorian. May the Lord be with you," he said. He walked away. He must have seen me eavesdropping because he made his way straight for the door. He walked into the room and gave me a worried look. "Were you listening?" he asked incredulously. I nodded, unable to lie to a priest. He began laughing. "Come along with me," he said. I walked alongside Father Care. He took my hand. "What is your friend's name?" he asked. I knew he must be speaking of Sean. Who else? "He is Sean, Father," I said. Father Care and I reached the stables. Sean was speaking to Mr. Adair. They both looked surprised to see us approach together. Mr. Adair tipped his hat. "Father Care, good morning," he said. "Good morning, sir," Father Care replied in a dry tone. He dropped my hand and I ran to Sean. Mr. Adair and Father Care spoke privately in low tones. They looked in our direction once. Mr. Adair seemed to be pondering something. He nodded and Father Care smiled. Father Care turned in our direction. "Children, I will meet you both before lunch in your rooms," he said. He gave us a faint, tight smile. "Yes, Father," we said in unison. Father Care walked away. Mr. Adair looked at Sean and shook his head. He walked away at a slow pace. I wondered if he was trying to keep a distance between himself and Father Care. Later that morning, we returned to our rooms as we had been instructed to do. Father Care was waiting for us when we arrived. Mr. Adair and Reverend Matarin were also present. Once we arrived, Mr. Adair greeted us and then left the room. Reverend Matarin seated himself in the one chair in the room. Sean and I were silent. We waited for one of them to speak to us. We didn't have to wait for long. "Hello, Aoife, Sean," Father Care said. "Hello, Father," we said in unison. "Hello, children," Reverend Matarin said. Once again, Sean and I answered in unison. "Mrs. Dorian wishes for Aoife to have her first Holy Communion. Mrs. Dorian is a Roman Catholic, so naturally she wishes for Aoife's first Holy Communion to be of the Roman Catholic Rite," Father Care said. "Mr. Adair would like your first Holy Communion to be of the Church of Ireland Rite," Reverend Matarin said, directing his gaze at Sean. Sean and I exchanged looks. I could see that he did not know how to respond. After some hesitation, he managed a response. "I believe that I was baptized in a Roman Catholic church." "Yes, you were," Father Care said. Reverend Matarin sighed. "A child should not have to make such a decision," Reverend Matarin said. "I agree," Father Care replied. "Holy Communion is a mass, and then you perform a miracle, and..." I began. "Yes, Aoife, I say a brief mass, but God performs the miracle. I am just his humble vehicle," Father Care said. "And Protestants do the same?" I asked. Reverend Matarin smiled and nodded. "Yes, we do the same," he said. "I think we should do both," I said. I turned to Sean and he smiled at me and nodded enthusiastically. "Yes, we want to do the same and we don't want to choose," he said. Father Care and Reverend Matarin exchanged looks. Reverend Matarin chuckled. "This is unorthodox in more ways than one, but I suppose no harm would be done," he said. Father Care gave him a smile. "I agree," he said. We spent the next hour listening to what must have been the first ever joint Roman Catholic and Church of Ireland Mass. When it was time for our Holy Communions, we both received Holy Communion twice. We said our prayers, but we were unable to say the prayers of either tradition properly. We still managed to get through our double ceremony. When we were receiving our last blessings, we heard a commotion. There was someone shouting outside. Sean glanced at me anxiously. "Children, we are almost finished," Father Kerr said. He gave us our final blessings and we raced out of the room. I could hear Reverend Matarin and Father Kerr chuckling as we did so. We rushed down the stairs. We ran through the hall and into the kitchen. We hurried out the back door. We ran around the house and hid ourselves near the side of the house so that we could watch. We crouched down and hid behind a large water barrel. I knew we couldn't possibly be completely hidden, but I wasn't too concerned that we would be noticed because I was certain that all eyes were on three young men and old man Seamus.